So, hi, I'm Sarah, and as Freddie said, I'm in postdoc here, like the other lectures that you've had. And over the next four lectures, we're going to talk a little bit about quantum information. I'm going to try and give you an introduction to quantum information theory. The idea is that the course will be relatively self-contained. I'm going to try not to assume too much prior knowledge, just that you know what complex numbers are, and that you're familiar with linear algebra, so you're happy with vectors and matrices and things like that. And as usual, there's a problem sheet to accompany the lectures. And the ones for this week are online already, and then there'll be another one for next week's lectures. So if you have any problems, if you need to contact me, my office is on the second floor, 252, or you can contact me by email. Feel free to drop by or email me. Yes. No, that I'll be due at the end of all the lectures. Yeah. So the problems aren't supposed to be too difficult. The idea is just that by trying, working out some of the details for yourself, you'll get a better understanding of what we're doing in the course. So do let me know if you have any trouble with them. Right, so what is quantum information theory? Well, what I'm going to be talking about is using quantum systems to encode information. Quantum information is a relatively new and still rapidly developing field. It was only 25 years ago, just over, that the first paper was written that could be said to be in this field. So it was pointed out that quantum systems can't be efficiently simulated using classical computers. And since then, there have been concepts like teleportation, cryptography. Some of these things you might have heard of already, we've talked about over the course of the lectures. Quantum algorithms have been found that can perform certain information processing tasks much faster than is possible classically. And it's a very multidisciplinary field for that reason. So there's computer science involved as well as physics. And so this brings together researchers from computer science, maths, theoretical physics, and experimental physics. And in all these areas, so theoretically, we're studying more about the properties of quantum systems, and so learning more about quantum mechanics. In computer science, there's quantum computational complexity theory, which looks at the very limit of what sort of things can be done information processing with physical systems. And in terms of the experimental work, experimental implementations are now manipulating single quantum systems. So this is all about the single quantum level, single atoms, photons, electrons. And this is really a big technological achievement. And even the founders of quantum theory didn't envisage this ever. And there's a nice quote from Schrödinger saying, "We never experiment with just one electron or atom or a small molecule. In thought experiments, sometimes we assume that we do, but this leads to ridiculous consequences. We're not experimenting with single particles any more than we can raise ichthyosauria in the zoo." And I've been practicing saying that all day. So, but now we really are experimenting with single quantum systems. And so what I'm trying to get across to you is that quantum information theory is sort of pushing the boundaries in all these fields, in computer science and theoretical and experimental physics. And it's a really exciting field in which to work and to learn about. So I've said it's multidisciplinary. I should say that I am a physicist, and so we'll be talking about the physics involved, quantum physics, and what it is about quantum systems that allows us to do things that are not possible classically. So the quote brings me to the references, because I took that quote from the introduction to one of these books. There's also a book list available on the website now. So the first two references here are sort of standard references for the field. And the second two are newer, they've just come out in the last year or so. particularly, where's my hockey stick? This one, I think, is a nice sort of accessible introduction. So the standard ones are very comprehensive and can be quite dense for that reason. So if you want more of a just general introduction, this one is at a nice level. It just covers quantum computing. And we'll be talking about quantum communication as well. But there's not so much of that in there. And this is also a relatively new one, which is at a sort of a nice level as well. And then I want to mention Sakurai's quantum mechanics. I don't know if you guys use this already, which I've always found is a very useful quantum mechanics reference book. It's good for things like the Stern Galactic experiment. I don't know if you guys have done that yet. Yes? No? Some of you? So, what are we going to talk about in these lectures? Well, this is a rough outline of what I'm hoping to cover over the next four lectures. So today we'll just be talking generally about what quantum information theory is, what's the difference between classical systems and quantum systems, how does this allow us to do things that are not possible classically, how we can use this for information processing. Then there's roughly two fields within quantum information theory. So one is quantum communication, in which we encode information in quantum systems and send it. So using quantum systems to communicate information. And the other is quantum computing, which uses quantum systems to process information. So in the quantum communication section, which will be on Thursday, we'll talk about some of these things. So teleportation and quantum key distribution, which you may or may not have heard of already. Teleportation tends to grab headlines and things. the public and media tend to be interested in these type things. What it really is moving a quantum state from one place to another without actually moving the quantum system. So we'll talk about that in more detail on Thursday. And quantum key distribution, which is applicable to cryptography. It's a way of distributing a private key, which is provably secure. And both of these protocols use entanglement as a resource. So we'll talk about entanglement is something which is specifically quantum mechanical and how that allows us to do things that are not allowed classically. Then next Tuesday, we'll talk about quantum computing. Quantum circuit diagram, so the circuit model of quantum computation, which allows us to visualize what a quantum computation is doing, and a little bit about quantum algorithms. So the Deutsch-Jose algorithm is quite a simple one, which involves looking at global properties of a function. So if you're not interested in the exact value of a function at any point, but you want to know something about global about it, for example, if the function is odd or even, but you don't care about its value at x equal to 3, then quantum computing can offer a speed up over what we can do classically. And the other one is the Grover search algorithm, which is one of a sort of class of algorithms, which involve, so we have a superposition state, and we want to manipulate the amplitudes within that superposition. So we'll get to that. And then the last lecture is supposed to be a bit more open-ended. We'll talk about what the problems with quantum computing are. What are the limits? What makes it difficult to realize large-scale computations? what is it that makes quantum computing more powerful than classical? And what sort of things that, is it really that much more powerful? So today this is all about what quantum information is. And before we can talk about quantum information, you need to recognize the point, which is that information is physical. So we think of information as being a sort of a more abstract concept. And physics is describing things which are real and tangible. So if you think of all the sources of information that you come across in a day, you might watch TV, you might talk to your friends, you might read a book. These all seem like more abstract things, so what has this got to do with physics? Well, ultimately, any information has to be included in a physical system. So that can be in the synapses of your brain, written down on a piece of paper, bits in a computer or a mobile phone. The important thing is that all information which we can perceive has to be encoded somehow in a physical system. And so what we can do with physical systems limits what sort of information processing things we can do, so what we can do with information. And how we process information or send it, transmit information, depends on the physical system in which that information is encoded. So quantum information theory is all about when the information is encoded in quantum systems. So why are we interested in this? Well, typically, my standard answer when friends and family ask me about what I do has something to do with Moore's law. And you may have heard of this already. Gordon Moore, who was one of the founders of Intel, said back in the 60s that it seemed like the number of components on an integrated circuit were doubling every year, and it seemed every 2 years, pardon, and it seemed set to continue. And actually, it's doubled every 18 months. So the size of components are getting smaller and smaller. You can fit more and more on a single chip. Well, that's great. But there's, of course, an ultimate limit to how small components can get. And if this continues, then in the next 10 or 20 years, we'll be talking about single atoms and single molecules. And at that stage, we need to really worry about quantum effects. So I should say at this point that we already make use of quantum effects for information processing, because just about everything in computers is based on quantum effects, semiconductor devices, lasers, transistors, everything. but these make use of bulk quantum effects. And when you get down to the single quantum level, you really have to talk about how single quantum systems behave. So as components continue to get smaller, there's a couple of things you can do. You can either treat this as noise on your computation and try to continue to do things classically, but deal with the extra noise that you get due to quantum effects. Or you can try and use and take advantage of these quantum effects. And that requires a whole new paradigm for information processing. But of course, that's not all there is to it. It's not just the fact that things are getting smaller. There are also interesting things that we can do with quantum systems. And this is what makes the study of information theory interesting. It was pointed out, as I mentioned earlier, by Benioff and Feynman and others back in the 80s, that quantum systems can't be efficiently simulated by classical computers. So clearly, a quantum system can be simulated by itself, for example. So there seems to be something that quantum systems can do that classical ones can't. So if you want to run a quantum simulation, you can always set up, in principle, an experiment of that quantum system and observe it, see what happens. So there are things that quantum systems can do efficiently that classical ones can't. And so these lines of thought led to the whole field of quantum information theory. thinking about what we can do using quantum systems to encode the information. So what else can we do with quantum systems that is not possible classically? Well, that's what it's all, that's what the course is all about and what quantum information theory is all about. And there's really some quite cool things, a number of which are here, and we'll talk about later. So in classical systems, we think of information as being encoded in bits. So a bit can take value 0 or 1, and in a computer, everything is in terms of bits. The quantum equivalent is a two-level system, which is referred to as a quantum bit or a qubit. But these are fundamentally different to classical bits because of things like superpositions, which we'll talk about in a bit, in a moment. So some examples of two-level systems. Two-level atom. So the ground state is, say, the zero level, and then it can also be excited to an excited state, which we designate the one level. And if we can manipulate these so that we can have superpositions of the two, then this forms a two-level system that we can use as a qubit. So some other examples, polarization of light, which I'll talk about in more detail now, and spin-a-half particles. So if you've done the Stern-Gerlach experiment, you already know about spin-half particles. If you haven't, we'll talk about them during the course of the four lectures. So I want to start with polarization of light, because polarization, I think, is something that people, most people are familiar with. So if you've ever had Polaroid sunglasses, the average person off the street knows what polarization is in that sense. And this forms a two-level system in quantum mechanics. So and the reason this is, if you think about this solution of Maxwell's equations in free space, the electric and magnetic fields are perpendicular to the direction of propagation. So the electric and magnetic fields are constrained to lie in a plane, which is perpendicular to the direction of propagation. And that's what I'm showing in this picture. And the direction of polarization is defined by the direction of the electric vector. So we have some electric vector. And these are just the plane wave solutions of Maxwell's equations. So, and the direction of the electric vector determines polarization. So there are two dimensions to which it's confined to a plane, which has two perpendicular directions. So for example, horizontal and vertical would be two perpendicular directions. So your light can be oscillating in this sense or in this sense, or anything in between. So any linear polarization can be written as a superposition of horizontal and vertical. And so have you guys seen Brown-Kett notation before? You have? Excellent. So if anybody hasn't, don't worry about the notation for the moment. I'll mention it again later. But the H just designates horizontal polarization and V vertical. So any linear polarization can be written in this way. And this just means that the plane of polarization is whatever, it's some angle. But there are other types of polarization, for example, circular polarization. And this is when the two waves are out of phase with pi over 2. So here we have some amplitude E, and then where these are just unit vectors in the x and y direction. So if the x and y components of the electric fields are out of phase by pi over 2, then we get this vector e to the I pi over 2 here. And And you can get complex amplitudes. So circular polarization can be written in this form, where the plus or minus corresponds to right or left circularly polarized light. And the idea is that because the two waves are out of phase, we have the one in the x direction going along like this, and the one in the y direction going along like this. And the plane of polarization rotates as time goes. Now, the most general case you can have is elliptical polarizations, where, in general, you have some angle theta and also some complex phase. And this is a general model for a two-level quantum system. So what can we do? What sort of measurements and transformations can we do with polarization? Because this all generalizes to two-level quantum systems. So the sort of optical components we have in the lab are, for example, polarizing beam splitter, which transmits one polarization and reflects the other. Can you see that at the bottom? Okay. Sure. I can write them out anyway. So well, what sort of things can we do with polarization in the lab to manipulate it? So one optical component is polarizing beam splitter. We use photodetectors to detect the light, and half-wave plates and quarter-wave plates rotate the plane of polarization of light. So a half or a quarter-wave plate is just a birefringent material, which the light experiences through different refractive indices. So if it travels in one direction, it travels faster than the if the polarization is one way, it travels faster than the polarization in another way. And you can use this to introduce a phase difference exactly like this in between the horizontal and vertical polarizations. In Jones matrix notation, do you guys know Jones matrix notation? Excellent. You can write the action of a half-wave plate and quarter-wave plate in this form. So what happens when you make a measurement of polarization? Well, just treating everything totally classically for a minute, if you have light of some polarization coming in from the left, it hits the polarizing beam splitter. The horizontal component is allowed through, the vertical component is reflected. And if you stick a detector here and here, it's the intensity of light which is registered. And the intensity goes with the square of the electric field. So if your input electric field is some E cos theta with sine theta, then here you detect an intensity of E squared cos squared theta, and here E squared sine theta. So in the case where you have a single photon, it can only be detected at one or other of the detectors. And the intensity becomes the probability to get a click in each detector. So the probabilities are just given by the square overlaps of the initial state with the measurement states. So we can think of we're measuring whether it's horizontal or vertical polarization. And of course, you can measure in any orthogonal basis by sticking some wave plate or something in the front that rotates into that basis. And so what happens when you measure it? Well, if the photon ends up here, then it really is horizontally polarized. And if it ends up here, it really is vertically polarized. So after the measurement, the state of the system is transformed. And this is typical of measurements on quantum systems. So in polarization measurements, we actually detect it here and here. But if you imagine there's some way in which we could detect where the photon is without actually absorbing it, then in this arm, you would have a horizontally polarized photon if you found it to be here. And in this arm, you would have a vertically polarized one. And the measurement is completely specified by these operators. So the probabilities can be written out in that form. That's supposed to be a psi. So the Brasquets you can think of as vectors in a linear, complex linear vector space. And there's an inner product on that space. And that obeys this rule. So if you flip the, swap the Brasquets, then you just take the complex conjugate. And so the square amplitude can be written out in long in this form. So the idea is that the measurement is completely specified by these operators, and the probability that I get one result or the other is given by the expectation value of these operators. So what are the properties of these operators? Well, they sum to the identity. They are Hermitian. Everybody know what Hermitian means? They're positive, and they're also orthogonal. And these are necessary, or at least three of them are necessary, to ensure that they can be interpreted as a probability distribution. Can anybody say which one is not necessary?
Why?
Just because I know the other three.
Okay. Right, so the positivity requirement means that the expectation value in all states is positive. And, okay, does anyone else want to guess? Do you guys agree with them? Anybody? Nobody else wants to take this hand? Okay, so we want to express probabilities as expectation values. And so back to this form. If it's to describe a probability distribution, it has to be positive. So these conditions correspond to, the first one means that for any state, the probabilities will add up to one, which they have to be if they want to be probabilities. The second state means that the expectation value, the second statement, means that this expectation value is always real if the operators are Hermitian. So again, if you want to describe a probability distribution, you expect probabilities to be real. So that has to hold. The third one, that they have to be positive, has to hold. You expect probabilities to be positive. There are some sorts of generalized probability theories, especially in relation to quantum mechanics, with negative probabilities, but in terms of predicting the probabilities of results of measurement, you want to be able to say that those probabilities are positive. In fact, the last one doesn't have to hold for general quantum measurements, because, well, what does it mean? Yep.
Shouldn't that be like the Kronecker delta if H and V are equal?
Well, in this case, H and V are H and V. They're horizontal numbers. So in the more general case, where we're talking about zeros and ones or whatever, then yeah, it would be the Kronecker delta. So this is just to give you a clue that there are actually more general types of measurements possible than the ones we usually talk about. So this is a standard von Neumann measurement. It's called a von Neumann measurement, which is a projective measurement. And that corresponds exactly to this situation. And in higher dimensional systems, it generalizes to be, I think, as you were getting at, a number of projective operators. Let's call them II, such that the sum over I is the identity. They're Hermitian, because if you swap them, you get the same thing. They're positive, and is that in the way there? I can't see that. That's okay. So this is just a generalization of this last part, right over here as well. So this is a standard measurement in quantum mechanics. It's a measurement along orthogonal directions. But more general things are possible in which this last one doesn't have to hold. But we're not going to talk about them today. So just a review of bracket notation. Everybody is familiar with this then, because anyone won't need to go over it. Everybody's OK? Great. So you can think of states as being vectors in a complex linear vector space. And the polarization example, I'm just using to sort of motivate this. Because, well, maybe you guys are totally comfortable with this, but when I first learned about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, finite dimensional quantum systems being described by Hilbert spaces, it seemed very mysterious. And it's difficult to separate the things that really are mysterious about quantum mechanics to the things that are mysterious about why do we describe it like this. And we describe them as vector spaces simply because of that's what describes the measurements properly. So in the case of polarization, it really is the case that these measurement operators completely determine how the measurement works. And so in more general quantum systems, where we don't have this analog, these sorts of measurements still occur and are well described by vector spaces. So for every ket, you have a bra in the dual space, and all that means is that there's an inner product. The inner product satisfies certain conditions. And then if you can form inner products, you can also form outer products, and these correspond to the operators on the space, which we've already seen. You can take Hermitian conjugates, and the operators that turn out to be important are Hermitian operators and unitary operators. So Hermitian operators, the expectation value is always real for any state, and they correspond to observables. And unitary operators preserve inner products, which is sort of important for the following reason. When, to go back to the probability interpretation of measurement, if I'm to evolve the state in some way and then make a measurement on it, well, I still want the probabilities to add up to one. And so the amplitude of the state, the square amplitude of the state, needs to be unaffected. And that's why evolution is always described by unitary operators. So if I have some state psi and some evolution, and it evolves to some other state phi, I can always write that in terms of some operator acting on phi. And then the condition that probabilities be conserved means that I still want psi to be equal to 1. And so this operator ends up having to be unitary. And that is indeed the case for polarization, in the case of polarization. When the sort of things that we can do are described by wave plates which rotate the polarization. And you can verify that these, if you could see these operators, are in fact unitary. So how is this related to the Schrodinger picture that you've learned about in the sort of first quantum mechanics courses that you do? Well, the state evolves by a unitary operator, and is what I've been telling you. And your standard Schrodinger equation looks like this in bracket notation. So if we just plug this in down here, you see that the unitary has to obey essentially the Schrodinger equation. And so for polarization systems, it's very easy to describe the sort of unitaries we can do in terms of half-wave plates and quarter wave plates. But for more general systems, we can generate any unitary evolution by choosing an appropriate Hamiltonian. And so manipulating systems is all about choosing the appropriate Hamiltonian to get the unitary that you want. So it's a very quick review of quantum mechanics of finite dimensions. States are represented as normalized state gets. A measurement is described as a projective measurement of projectors along orthogonal directions. And the probability of getting a given result is given by the overlap of the quantum state with the direction being measured. And so I've said evolution is unitary. That corresponds to closed systems. the system is interacting with another system, the evolution can be more complicated. And perfect discrimination is possible in principle between mutually orthogonal states. And I say in principle because it may be difficult to perform the measurement. But if you have a system which is known to be in one of a number of orthogonal states, you can just do the von Neumann measurement onto those states, project into those states. So we've been talking about closed systems. If a system interacts with another system, then we need to talk about the system as a whole. So, and that's when we get things like entanglement. So for composite systems, if I have a system A and a system B, and system A is in some state alpha and system B is in some state beta, I can always write that as a product in this way. And it's really a tensor product, but if you don't know what that is, it's not too important at this stage. So I've missed out the tensor product symbol there. All this means is that system A is in state alpha and system B is in state beta. Fine. But the tensor product structure is important because the vector space in which the two systems live is described by a tensor product vector space. And what that means is that more general states of the system are allowed, which cannot be written as product states. So essentially this, you can think of this as coming from the superposition principle of quantum mechanics. So in classical mechanics, we have a bunch of states that a system is allowed to be in. In quantum mechanics, we have a bunch of states that the system is allowed to be in, and it can be in any superposition of that, of those states. And that's also what gives us this vector space structure, the superposition principle. And in particular, for two systems, if all states of this form are allowed, then superpositions of these states are also allowed. And I've said there at least in principle, because quantum mechanics allows it, but it's not necessarily easy to create states of this form. There are techniques. And so the entangled states quite often arise in nature, but to actually create them can be difficult. And the important thing to notice about this state is that it cannot be written in this form. It cannot be written as a product of a given state in one system and another given state in the other system. So there's some correlations between the systems. So can you guys see that okay? Yes? Okay. So I think you've learned a bit about entanglement and Bell's inequalities with Owen and maybe Philip already. So what we're going to talk about is mainly how we can use entanglement in quantum information, and not so much about the concept itself. So I've said that the space for two systems is a tensor product space. So for example, for two qubit systems, the first system has a basis 0 and 1, the second system has a basis 0 and 1. And the combined system has a four-dimensional Hilbert space, or four-dimensional vector space. And these states form a basis for that space. So you can equivalently think of product states as a basis. So this is a perfectly good basis. But we've said that entangled states are also possible, and this just forms another possible basis for the system. And these states are important in that they're maximally entangled, which means they give maximum violation of Bell's inequalities, which you did with Owen, right? Yes, I'm pretty sure you did. So these have some correlations between the systems. So for example, in this last state, if I measure the first system and find it to be in state 0, the second system will always be found to be in state 1. And these sort of correlations are not allowed classically. And that's what Bell's inequalities are all about. So just to mention briefly one way in which these states can be created in the laboratory is by a technique known as parametric downconvergence. And the idea is that you have a birefringent crystal and it's pumped by a laser. And the crystal absorbs one photon and emits two. And the two photons that are emitted are correlated because they need to obey things like momentum conservation and energy conservation. And in this case, the type 2 case, the two photons which are emitted are in cones. So one along here and one along the cone in the bottom. And they have opposite polarizations. So the top has, say, horizontal polarization, and the bottom has vertical. But these have some correlations because of how they were created. They're created through an interaction. And so they're entangled. And in particular, if you look at these regions here and here, so this is the cross-section of the two cones, where the photons are indistinguishable, you can create states which are entangled in polarization. So Bell states for polarization. And these are the sort of states that have been used to show teleportation and cryptography. So that was a quick review of quantum mechanics. Now we're going to go on to some cool things that you can do with it. Are there any questions on quantum mechanics?
Okay. That was annoying. It's fine, but yes, I have a question.
So the first thing we're going to talk about is the no cloning theorem, which is sort of a weird property of quantum mechanics. Because if you think about classical information, you can always copy it, right? If you write something down, you can always put it through a photocopier and make a copy of it. Quantum mechanics doesn't allow this. And the reason is the following. So arbitrary quantum states cannot be cloned. And this comes about because of the linearity of quantum mechanics. So we've talked about that quantum mechanics is in vector spaces, and the operators on these spaces are linear. So let's suppose that you could clone arbitrary quantum states. So what would that entail? Well, if I start off with some system, some state of a system A, and some arbitrary state of system B. I want to perform some operator on the joint system such that after the operator, I have a copy of the first system in system B, first state in system B. So suppose there exists a perfect cloner. So for any state of system A, I can just apply this operator and get a copy of it in system B. Well, how would that work on the basis states of system A? Well, the basis states are 0 and 1, and it would work exactly as you want it to. But suppose I now consider a superposition. Is this a bit small? Can you guys see the last bit? Yeah, right. Let's consider the action of this operator on a superposition state. Well, we know what it does to state 0, and we know what it does to state 1. So we can calculate what it does to the superposition state. And this is where the linearity of quantum mechanics comes in. So if B acting on 0 psi is 0, 0, and B acting on 1 psi is 1, 1, then we get this state as the output. But that state is entangled. That's not a product state. And in particular, it's not a copy. It's not. The second state is not a copy of the first. So it can't be written in this way at all. It's an entangled state. But in particular, we haven't copied the state of the first system onto the second. And this is a general. This is a theorem about quantum mechanics. And so, in general, when we're using quantum systems to encode information, you can't just copy that information and send it to someone. And this turns out to be important in things like cryptography. I'll get to later. Now, the first application I want to talk about is dense coding, super dense coding. So let's suppose Alice and Bob share one of these entangled states. So this is one of the Bell states. And we can think of this like a quantum channel. So somebody else, there's somebody in the middle, and they send one part to Alice and one part to Bob. So by the way, we often use Alice and Bob to talk about people in quantum mechanics. It comes up all the time in cryptography and things. So you'll notice that I keep calling people Alice and Bob. So Alice has one state and Bob has the other. And the state of the combined system is this entangled state at the top. Now, what can Alice do to that entangled state? Well, just using local operations, Alice can convert that state into any one of the other Bell states. And do you believe me, or should I show you? So we start off with this combined state, and the first qubit is the one that Alice has, and the second qubit is the one that Bob has. Now, suppose Alice performs some local operations. So she can only act on her cube, but she doesn't have access to Bob's one. Well, this is an example of an operator that Alice could apply to her qubit. And all it does is flips the value of her qubit. And you can verify that that's unitary. It just flips the qubit. It does nothing to the amplitude. So if I act with this operator on the initial Bell stage, what do I get? Well, this operator is only acting on the first qubit. It's only acting on Alice's qubit. And what does it give me? Well, one is orthogonal to the zero, so this gives me no component for the first term. The one and the one gives a one, but becomes zero. So is that clear? Okay. So this is just a local operation that Alice can perform. And when she acts on the on her half of the entangled state, she converts this stage to this one, which is one of these other Bell states, the second one there. What other kind of things can she do? Well, if we look at the form of the other operators, of the other states, rather. This one is just this one with a minus sign. So if Alice can perform some local operator, which just flips the sign on her as if it's one, then she can convert this state to the other. And then finally, the last state is exactly this operator applied to this state. So all these things you can do locally. But Alice just acts on one of the qubits, and she can transform the joint state of the qubit into one of four possible orthogonal states. So
what's the point?
Well, suppose Alice and Bob share this state, and Alice wants to send a message to Bob. Well, to encode the message 00, she does nothing to her qubit, and the state remains in the state she had to start up with. If she wants to encode 01, she applies exactly the operator I wrote there, which, if you've already seen the Pauli operators, is just the Pauli X operator. So it just flips her bit. If she wants to encode the message 10, she can apply the Z operator, just introducing a minus sign between the two terms. And finally, if she wants to encode the message 11, she can apply the X and then the Z. And using these operations, she can produce any one of the four states. And then she sends her qubit to Bob. And Bob now has, both systems, and he knows it's in one of these four orthogonal states. And they're orthogonal, so he can discriminate between them. But now, by sending just one system, Alice has sent two bits of information, because she could have sent 00011011. And there's no classical analog of this. So all Alice had to do was send one system to Bob, one two-level system, which can only encode one bit of information. But because they share a quantum channel, she can actually send two bits of information. And this is why it's called super dense code. Any questions? So that's the first sort of cool thing that you can do with quantum mechanics that you can't do with classical mechanics. And the second one that we're going to talk about today is an algorithm, a Deutsch algorithm. So suppose I have a black box which computes the value of a given function. And we often talk about things being black boxes, meaning I don't know what's inside in it, but I want to know something about the function that it computes. So I have this black box, and it acts in this way. So for some given input, x and y, it computes f of x, and it puts it in the qubit y. And let's say I want to know whether f of 0 and f of 1 are the same or different. So first of all, this is just a binary function. So it can take input 0 or 1, and the outputs are either 0 or 1. So it's a really, really simple case. And it's just to demonstrate, it's I think the first quantum algorithm that was ever come up with. And nobody's claiming that it's for something really useful, but it just demonstrates what we can do with quantum systems. So suppose I want to know whether the f of 0 and f of 1 are the same or different. Well, classically, what would I do? I would take the black box, and I would put input 0, and I would output f of 0. And then I would take the black box and input 1 and output f of 1, and then I would check to see whether they were the same or different. So there's nothing better than this you can do classically. You have to evaluate both f of 0 and f of 1 and compare them. So what about quantum mechanically? Is there anything, is there any advantage I can get over using quantum, by using quantum mechanics? And the superposition principle means that, in essence, I can calculate both values at the same time. So instead of feeding in 0 or 1 to the black box and getting out f of 0 or f of 1, I can put in 0 and 1 at the same time. So from just one call to the black box, or to the function, I can compute both values, f of 0 and f of 1. So the simplest way you could sort of think of using the superposition is like this. So I initialize the qubit y to just be 0. And the qubit x is in some superposition state, 0 plus 1. And when I feed that through the black box, the y qubit gets the values f of 0 and f of 1. But now what do I do? Well, the information is there in the quantum state, but to get at it, I have to make a measurement. And if I make a measurement, the system will collapse into 0 or 1, and I still only get one result. So is there anything better we can do? And the answer, of course, is yes. Suppose both the qubits are in superposition state. And now, so I'm calling it the target and the control. The target is the y qubit, and the control is the x qubit, because what happens to the y qubit depends on the x, so it's controlled by the value of the x qubit. So now let's suppose that they're both in superposition states. So this bit needs to explain. So let's consider that the input to the black box is a superposition state in Y. This form. What happens when I evaluate the function? So the system gets transformed like this. Now, the possible values that f of 0 can take are 0 or 1. So if f of 0 is 0, then what does this state look like? Well, it's just exactly the state that we put in, exactly the starting state. Now, what about if f of 0 is 1? Then, so, this just means addition modulo, binary addition, so modulo 2. So if f of 0 is 1, then this becomes 1. And this one becomes 0. Right? So that's fine. That's the initial state, but now it's got a sign attached with it. So this is the negative of this. So another way of writing that is as follows. So that's my starting state. And if the value of f of 0 is 0, it stays the same. If the value of f of 0 is 1, it picks up a minus sign. So I can write this like this. And that form. And similarly, if the input is 1, well, it doesn't do anything to the operation doesn't do anything to the control qubit, only to the target qubit. And the exact same argument holds. So if the input was 1, it would be transformed in this way. Is that clear to everyone? Because this comes up all the time in quantum information, in the things we're going to discuss the next day. So the idea is that by starting with this superposition state for the target qubit, the operation of the black box is to multiply it by a minus 1 if f of 0 is 1, and to multiply it by plus 1 if f of 0 is 0. So it's moving the eigenvalue to the, it's just associating an eigenvalue with the superposition stage. Okay. Okay, so what happens now if we input a superposition as the control qubit? Well, now we can put these two together. And this also illustrates one of the sort of strange aspects of quantum information processing as opposed to classical. Because we said that one qubit was the control qubit and the other was the target qubit. So the second qubit is the one which changes as a result of the operation, not the first one. But if we put in a state like this, actually the second state remains exactly the same. And it's the first state which has changed. So what's the idea here? Well, if I put in that superposition state, as I've just shown, we get this output. It's in here. Now, if f and 0 and f of 1 are the same, then this is just some phase times 0 plus 1. So this is the output of the control qubit. If f of 0 and f of 1 are different, then there's a minus sign somewhere. And the control qubit is in an orthogonal state. Okay. So the idea is that by just calling the function once, just using the black box once, we can find out something about the global properties of the function. So we put in this input state, and depending on whether f and 0 are the same or different, we get orthogonal output states. And we can just measure which one of the output states the control qubit is in and determine something about the global properties of the function. So we didn't have to evaluate f of 0 and f of 1 separately and measure them and then compare them. We could do it all in one step using a quantum algorithm. So the main idea is that because quantum mechanics allows for superposition states, we can do this thing of calculating both values at once. But you have to be a little bit careful about what your input state is in order to use this to get something useful at the end. And so this is one reason why it's difficult to design quantum algorithms, because you need to be a little bit careful in that sense. It's not as simple as that the computer can calculate everything all at once and then you can get the answers. So what's the difference between classical and quantum information? Well, classical information is stored as zeros and ones in a bit. And the value a classical bit can have is only zero or one. And there's all sorts of classical systems, punch cards, charge in a capacitor, whether there's current flowing or not, magnetic storage in the computer. In quantum information, we have the analog is a two-level system, or a qubit, which, just like the classical system, has two distinct states, 0 and 1. But because we have a superposition principle in quantum mechanics, we're also allowed to have superpositions of these states. And this allows for quantum parallelism, so being able to perform a computation on many inputs at once. So what have we talked about today? The no-cloning theorem, which is something which has no classical analog. There's no copying of quantum information. entanglement, which are quantum correlations, which are stronger than are allowed classically. And we started to show a bit about how that can be used as a resource in quantum information. And finally, what we were just talking about with the superposition principle, which allows this sort of parallelism in quantum information processing. And sometimes it's possible to use this to investigate global properties of the function efficiently. So something about the function in general rather than specific values. And we're going to finish a little bit early today. You can have as many levels as you want, depending on the physical system. So, for example, I talked earlier about polarization, using polarization of light. Alternatively, you can use quanta of light. So, single photon states are orthogonal to two photon states, which are orthogonal to three photon states, and there's no limit to how many photons you can have, so that's an infinite dimensional system. We usually think about two-number systems because Well, it's sort of an extension of the classical idea of bits. They're the simplest ones to think about. And you can do anything with, because two-level systems together can be considered a four-level system and so on, you can do whatever you want with as many qubits as you want. So you can simulate a larger quantum system just using lots of two-level systems. Yes?
So, yeah, so in those examples, there was two-level systems, and you're saying you can use the position, the superposition principle, right? So that would be like a superposition of two vectors, the alpha and beta, or 0 and 1.
Yep.
But if you were to talk about that, like, using algebra, like, that would be, what vector space would that be over? Exactly. Like R2 or C2?
So they're complex. Complex vectors, in general complex vectors.
So that's what his question was. You could have like a vector on in the vector space, like C5.
Yes, exactly.
That would just be more complicated.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. But basically, because we're still at the level of trying to control single quantum systems, the easiest things to think about are two-level systems, experimentally as well as theoretically. There are also things like, it's the spin of the photon that gives it the polarization, the left and right circuit polarization. Photons also have angular momentum, which also has infinite, discrete but infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And there's sort of some work into using that for information processing.
So, like, an operator, it would have to be Hermitian to be observable, right? But can you have, like, just random, like, operators like you would have in linear algebra, like a linear operator, but that's not, it would change a quantum system, but you can't measure it? Like, does that exist if you're just taking the mathematics of it?
Yes, that does exist.
Is that helpful? Or?
And this corresponds to these more general type measurements that I was talking about. In general, you can have some systems, some state psi, which gets transformed by some operator. I'm going to put labels K on it, the AK psi. And you can talk about the most general transformations that are allowed in quantum mechanics. And it turns out that the allowed, so when you make a measurement, there are a number of these operators, AK, and they don't have to be Hermitian or unitary or anything. And depending on the outcome of the measurement, the state gets transformed like this. What they do have to obey is the sum over K. And all that means is that the outcomes are exhaustive. So there are a number of different ways in which the state can transform, but it has to transform via one of them. So yes, there are more general operators, and they do have physical meanings in some sense. But these sort of transformations you can always think of as a unitary on a larger dimensional number space, and then a measurement of some auxiliary system, and then this is the effect on the smaller system.
Just because, like, in the quantum course we've taken, it's just like, you know, the operators that we're talking about are these, you know, like angular momentum, all that stuff. But I guess with this, it wouldn't really be like define like measurements, like. The operators that you're talking about aren't like physical. Well, I guess they can be, but you know, there's got to be other ones that we can't just define as being like, you know, energy.
Sure. So these operators that I'm talking about are effects rather than observables. So what happens is the state transforms in a certain way, and the observable associated with it is Hermitian, and is this part, AK Jagger, which is a positive Hermitian operator, and defines a measurement. So it satisfies all those things that a measurement satisfies except the orthogonality. That's one. So yeah, general operators are not observable. But they do have a role. Anything else? Great.